This is Beyond Species, a podcast exploring issues around speciesism and the struggle to dismantle it. I'm Tofu Steve, and welcome to the episode. In this episode, we hear from Jamie. Jamie advocates for human and non-human animal rights using the philosophy of sentientism as an ethical grounding. Sentientism uses evidence and reason to inform our moral decision-making. Jamie explains how anti-speciesism and sentientism can be combined, but how this can also be problematic for some anti-speciesist activists. He also digs deeper into some of the questions posed by sentientism in relation to veganism, environmentalism, and artificial intelligence. Do you want to start then by telling us about your animal advocacy and human rights background? How you came to that?
Yeah, I've long had an amateur interest in both of those fields, and I guess in the last two or three years, I've got a little bit more serious about those two fields, but also linking them together. So I grew up originally in a fairly, normal, anodyne English religious background, which only really considered religion at Easter and Christmas, and that was it. But in my teenage years, I did start to read and think through the implications of that, and I guess became atheist when I was, 13 or 14. So that was the first time I started thinking about ethics, if you like, in a very amateur sense, and philosophy. From there, I got interested in the worldview of humanism, because atheism in itself says nothing about morality whatsoever. It's just the absence of a belief in deity. So it leaves a vacuum, if you like, that needs filling. And humanism, to me, felt like a really positive force for good there, because it replaced a lot of the drivers and thinking from the supernatural with a much more scientific, reality-grounded ethics that just says, look, we should have compassion for all humans, and to do that in an equal way. So to me, that felt like a very positive way of building ethics scientifically in the real world without the need for any, supernatural elements to it as well. So I moved from atheism to, I guess, a commitment to humanism reasonably early on. I didn't necessarily think about how that linked into the animal ethics world at first at all. I almost saw them as separate themes of thought. And I went vegetarian when I was in my mid-20s, a few decades ago, and have been vegan for almost 3 years now. But only really started to link those two topics together in the last few years. And that's culminated in this sentientism project that I'm trying to drive forward at the moment. Mm-hmm. And where that, one way of looking at that is if you start from a commitment to evidence and reason, you build your ethics around a universal compassion for all humans, the obvious next question is, well, why stop there? It's very clear that many other non-human animals also have the capability to suffer and to flourish. So why should we draw the ethical boundary in a way that excludes them? And in a way, that's what this sentientism idea does, is extends that humanist moral circle out to include, all sentient beings. So that, those two themes of, human rights and ethics and animal advocacy started out as separate trains of thought and then increasingly have come together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was it then that made you go veggie and then vegan, if it wasn't the, if you weren't making the links that make up sentientism at that time, there was something else ethically pushing you in that direction?
There was, and it was in simple terms, it was based on a compassion for, sentient non-human animals. So at least at some level, there was a common theme of compassion and very simply not wanting to cause unnecessary suffering that was driving growth. Mm. But I still hadn't really linked the two topics or thought of them as something that needed to be integrated together at that point. Mm-hmm. But it was always very clearly an ethical driver on the animal side.
Yeah. Okay, then. Do you want to define what sentientism is?
Yeah, in a sentence, it's a commitment to evidence and reason in all things and compassion for anything that is sentient. So that's it in a sentence. Mm-hmm. And you can break it down into two pieces. The first is, how do we decide what is true or what is real? And that's evidence and reason. So it's a naturalistic commitment to using evidence and using reasoning to form beliefs. So it rejects supernatural arguments or religious arguments or purely traditional arguments. So that's the first part. How do we choose what to believe in and what is true? And the second part is, what should we care about morally? And in that context, the answer is we should have moral consideration for anything that is sentient. And sentience, I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with the term, but in its simple terms, it's the capacity to experience things, whether that's suffering or flourishing or well-being, however you want to frame it. Mm-hmm. So it brings those two things together. It said we should only believe in things for which there is evidence and we can reason towards, but we should have moral consideration and therefore compassion for anything that is capable of suffering or experiencing things.
Mm. Okay. And going back to humanism then, didn't humanism originally come about in the Renaissance era? Something to do with, you know, defining the human and stepping away from that kind of, like you say, the supernatural elements of things, rationalism, reason. So it's kind of very anthropocentric in a way. So how does humanism, or with sentientism, I guess, you're trying to extend humanism, how is that kind of workable if we think of humanism as something that is really trying to benefit humans?
To my mind, humanism has already been, you know, is already going on this journey to an extent already. So humanism has increasingly become an explicitly naturalistic, so a non-religious worldview, although there are still, you know, religious people who will describe themselves as humanists because they still subscribe to the sort of universal compassion for all humans and the equality perspective within that. Mm. But it has increasingly become a explicitly naturalistic worldview. And you'll see that in the definitions that are used by Humanists UK and International Humanists and some of the other major charities and NGOs that promote humanism. They've also made some positive steps, and I do think this is important, towards acknowledging and granting moral consideration for non-human sentient animals as well. So if you look into their definitions at the more detailed level, you will find, you know, a bullet point here or there that does talk about granting moral consideration for non-human animals as well, which I think is entirely positive. So the degree to which the humanist movement, even while it's still called humanism, is expanding its moral circle and starting to get more serious about non-human animal ethics as well. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the movement and you look at humanists in general, while, you know, on average it does appear more humanists are, for example, ethical humans than in the wider population, as you might expect, right? These are people committed to universal compassion and an evidence-based viewpoint. You'd expect them on average to you know, agree with us animal advocates more than the average. Most of them still don't. And I think that is because of the anthropocentrism that is at the heart of humanism. You know, the clue is in the name. If the entire movement and the worldview is based around the name of one species and one species alone, that is bound to have an influence in the way the humanism movement progresses. So I don't want to ignore the fact that they've made some positive steps, but I think they are still held back by a very strong anthropocentric culture and history. So most humanists, you know, might acknowledge that they should have moral consideration for non-human sentient animals, as in the definition of humanism, but most of them still aren't vegetarian or vegan and clearly aren't taking, you know, those ethics to heart in a practical way. And when you look at the campaigns that humanist organizations run, they are almost exclusively about humans. So there's a very strong focus on resisting religious privilege and arguing for civic equality for the non-religious, which are, you know, important aims that I wholeheartedly subscribe to. But there's very little that goes beyond the human, and where there are campaigns that talk about, you know, for example, religious methods of animal slaughter, those campaigns seem more to be driven by resisting religious privilege than they are about a genuine concern for reducing animal suffering. So I'd say it in two ways. One, you could see sentientism as you know, an extension of humanism, because it's explicitly rejecting that anthropocentrism. It's explicitly saying, this isn't about humans, this is about all sentience. And for me, that works well, because it negates the anthropocentrism and it recenters it on sentience. Sentience existed before humans did, and arguably morals and ethics existed before humans did. So to me, that feels like the right way to go. Others are nervous of any association with humanism whatsoever because of its anthropocentrism, and I can understand that too. But whichever way you approach it, whether you see it as an extension of humanism or whether you see it as something that's radically new and just totally focuses on sentience and sentient beings, I think you get to the same place.
Okay. So how do we define or measure sentience then?
Yeah, that's a central question, and we don't have a perfect answer. I think we have a good definition, which is the capacity to experience things qualitatively. But assessing it is tricky and imperfect. And in a way, you can think about how we assess sentience in our fellow humans. You know, in a sense, you and I can't be 100% confident that the other is fully sentient or conscious, but there's a few ways we can work it out, or we can you know, come to some degree of confidence that it's likely. One is through inferring it from behavior. So the fact that you and I are talking, the fact that, you know, if we were in a room together, we could see each other acting and responding, would give us some decent inference that we're sentient. Two is from actually looking at functioning and architecture, and whether you could do that through fMRI scans or other mechanisms. You can look at we can look at each other and think, well, I'm 100% confident I'm sentient because I'm experiencing that moment to moment. You know, you can see that as the foundational fact. But if you, Steve, have, you know, a similar brain architecture to me, and there are patterns of firing going on that, you know, look roughly similar to mine, I can have a decent level of confidence that you're sentient too. So I think we can apply that more broadly. So as you look at, you know, the neural architecture of non-human animals, or even more broadly than that, and as you look at the behavior of many non-human animals, I think it's a fair inference that they're sentient too. But it's imperfect and it's probabilistic. So, you know, I'm not saying there's a perfect way of detecting sentience, and I'm also not I'm not suggesting that it's something that's very easy to draw a very clear dividing line around either.
Yeah, because I suppose one of the strong messages or most common messages of the animal rights movement is along the lines of, you know, pigs are intelligent, for example, they're not that different to humans. Animals experience the world in all the ways that matter. But then if you think about the sentience of a pig and the sentience of, for example, an aphid, there seems to be, or I guess sentientism would say there's a spectrum along there. So how do we decide, like, which elements of sentience are important or not?
Yeah. I draw a distinction here between my personal view and what sentientism is itself. So deliberately, I'm trying to reframe sentientism, which is a term that's been around for a long while. It was developed by people like Peter Singer and Richard Ryder in the 1970s and 80s. But I'm trying to reframe that as a very simple, almost baseline philosophy. So it doesn't try and answer all of the questions. It doesn't try and resolve all of the difficult moral trade-offs. It just in one sentence says we're committed to evidence and reason, and we have at least some significant moral consideration for every sentient being. That's it. There's no more, there's no less. So within that frame, some sentientists will insist that we need to grant equal moral consideration for everything that is sentient. You know, so they may say, look, there's no such thing as degrees of sentience. It's binary. It's on or off. Or they might say there are degrees of sentience, but it doesn't matter, because who are we to judge the character of those different types of sentience? We should still grant equal moral consideration to them all. So some sentientists do talk about, you know, complete equality across, if you like, the entire sentient animal kingdom. And they might answer your question to say, well, if an aphid is sentient and a pig is sentient, we should give them equal moral consideration. So those people, you know, there are sentientists who think that way. There are others, and this includes me, who do think that sentience is more likely to be a question of degree. And maybe there are even, you know, completely different types of sentience and, you know, multiple styles, which could have very different types of richness as well. I mean, I see sentience as a class of very advanced information processing. So you can, there's an almost unimaginable richness of possible types of sentience out there. And you can imagine, you know, the sentience of a pig or a bat or an aphid, if aphids are sentient, or a human, being very, very different. So I do think it's fair to consider, you know, differential moral consideration. You know, so if you're looking at the moral consideration you grant to a human versus a pig versus a chicken versus an aphid versus a scorpion, you know, I do think it's fair to grade. Now, sentientism still says for all of those sentient things, you still have to grant them some level of moral consideration that means you wouldn't want them to be needlessly harmed or killed. Mm-hmm. So there's still that baseline being drawn, but it does allow people like me to say, you know, there probably are grades within that that we could use to think about moral trade-offs.
Okay. Yeah, I think with veganism and animal rights, there seems to be a really strong focus on compassion as the kind of driver for getting people on board with not exploiting animals. So if we can just convince people or get people to connect somehow with this deep compassion that we're all supposedly are able to access, then we will start to feel compassion for all living beings and we'll just stop exploiting them. But with sentience seeming, you know, quite scientific and about evidence and things like that, where does compassion and morality fit into that? Because compassion always seemed to me, I may be wrong, but my impression of it is that compassion is like the kind of spiritual part of humanity, the thing that we can't really you can't really measure it, but I'm sure we have measured it. But where does compassion and morality fit in, I guess, to this picture?
And that's what I think is powerful, both about humanism, but also about sentientism. I think it actually grounds the deep moral importance of compassion in a much more solid way than relying on the mystical or the supernatural. Because the fact that I understand that, you know, my mind is a physical artifact that is following the laws of physics, that even my free will is, likely illusory, and that in a way I am just patterns of energy and matter, to me makes the experiences I'm having seem even more awesome and even more wonderful and even more important to protect than if there was some sort of mystical, magical life force that was flowing through me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So when I shift from a supernatural worldview or a religious worldview or even some other form of mystical worldview into one that's completely grounded in science and physical reality and evidence and reason, if anything, I get an even richer sense of awe. I don't feel like I've lost anything through that transition. I feel that, if anything, the world is more awesome based on, you know, evidence and reality and understanding of how things really are than just assuming some sort of magical force that drives them. But I do understand that for some people that feels like a loss. They feel like, you know, something can't be wonderful, it can't be awesome, it can't be emotionally or ethically important if it's just matter and energy. Whereas as I make that transition, as many others make that transition, if anything, you know, it enriches the morality, it enriches the compassion, and frankly grounds it in a much more foundational way that doesn't require beliefs for which there is no evidence. I do understand that's a difficult transition and some people feel like they're losing something, but I'd reassure them that there's no need to lose anything.
It's an interesting one because I find that I think maybe generally speaking, in the animal rights movement, there isn't a great deal of commitment to using like evidence and research-based approaches to our campaigns. You know, thinking about like really looking into the psychology of the messaging that we're using, theories of social change, how people behave. We seem to have clung to this pseudo-religious notion of compassion and morality, that if we can just get, it's all about feeling and emotion, you know? So if we can get people to feel and connect emotionally with animal suffering, then they will empathize and understand. And so I feel like we've maybe gone way too much down that kind of avenue, and we're a bit off balance with that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the impression I get. I think it's a problem in a couple of ways. I think unless your statements and your arguments are grounded in evidence and reason, they're much more open to attack. So you can see this even flame wars on Twitter about veganism. You know, if people making on the animal advocacy, in the animal advocacy movement, are making arguments that are poorly founded, you will get ripped to pieces, right? So if there's purely an emotional appeal or a mystical appeal or a sort of woolly environmentalism, that leaves us much more open to attack. Whereas if we do base our fundamental arguments on evidence and reason and research and a scientific worldview, it gives us a much stronger foundation to work from. But to your point, that's also critical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough just to have this emotional appeal and a sort of naive hope that everybody will just agree with us because, you know, they won't be able to argue against our compassionate, open-minded, broad moral circle. You know, we know through harsh experience that is just not sufficient. You know, we need to genuinely understand social change. We need to understand how the human mind works. We need to understand the value of different types of campaigns. And the only way to really improve the effectiveness of the animal advocacy movement over time is to, you know, build up that evidence and to reason carefully and to do what really, really works to reduce suffering. You know, it's not enough just to wring our hands and, you know, assume everyone will magically come to agree with our moral stance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to something you said earlier, you said that morals and ethics possibly were around before humans.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this links to your point, right? I think people are nervous about anthropocentrism, rightly, right? Because it, you know, it's caused enormous harm. Mm. But they also shouldn't be too stuck on humanism and anthropocentrism and dependent even in their criticism on the human root of ethics and morals, because actually many of the things we're talking about, in some, at least in some rudimentary form, existed well before humans did. So even from the dawn of the most fundamental life, arguably, you know, animals and plants and other things were using evidence of the reality around them and some form of rudimentary reasoning, even if they weren't conscious of it, to respond to their surroundings. So, you know, that commitment to evidence and reason is just about really surviving and persisting in the physical world long before organisms developed that were conscious of the fact they were actually taking evidence and doing reasoning. You know, I'd argue that organisms have used evidence and reason for a long while. That's why we're still here. So those elements of, you know, if you like, belief forming or reacting in the world have been around for a long, long while before humans came on the scene. And certainly the more advanced animals that existed before humans were explicitly using evidence and some form of reasoning in their, you know, in their daily lives. And humans may well have taken that to an unparalleled level, and we may be able to do types of reasoning and types of evidence gathering and types of cultural transmission that, you know, are a leap ahead of any other species. But that doesn't mean that those other species weren't in a rudimentary form using evidence and reason for a long while. And the same is true of morality, right? One of the sort of books that opened my eyes a long while ago is by a chap called Robert Axelrod, and it was called The Evolution of Cooperation. And it talks about how cooperation and ways of working together can emerge purely from self-interested interactions and through logic. And again, you can see that way before humans ever came on the scene in other forms of animals, where there were you know, there's kin cooperation, there's tribal cooperation, there's reciprocity, you know, many sort of behaviors that really are the foundations of morality and ethics existed long before humans came on the scene. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, again, I'm trying to break up this sort of anthropocentric view that humans are, you know, some sort of amazing pinnacle of both epistemology and ethics, and actually say, look, the foundations of them are deeper than humans and predate humans. So we don't really need to focus on the human species. You know, we are important. We are awesome. we're special in many ways, mm-hmm. but we don't need to focus on humans to have a really well-founded and well-grounded morality.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting one with nature, because I think in veganism that there seems to be this, like in vegan advocacy, when people are coming up against non-vegans will often obviously point to nature and the circle of life, and if you were a lion, what would you do, and so on. And then the vegans will come back and go, well, you know, look at, you know, factory farming is not natural. It's not to do with the circle of life, and these kind of sort of games, I guess, that people play in trying to figure out what's natural and what's not.
Yeah.
So I think in veganism, we want to almost go back to like a more natural way of living. And there's this thing about, you know, what could be more natural than to eat fruit plucked from a tree? But there's this kind of like a disjunction between how do we and should we go back to more natural ways of living?
Yeah.
Is there some truth in the fact that we were, you know, that cavemen didn't need to eat meat, for example, you know, all this kind of stuff?
Yeah, and I think it's a dangerous road, right? Because in essence, I'm not really that interested in what's natural or what's not natural. Mm. I'm interested in suffering and flourishing, mm-hmm. right? So I think you're right. And I have a lot of empathy for this sort of reverence for the natural and a sort of emotional connection to some imagined, you know, traditional past where everything lived in harmony with everybody else. But it just didn't exist. And two, it's not really relevant to the balance of suffering and flourishing today. So I think there are some themes in the animal advocacy and the vegan movements which do rely on a sort of woolly environmentalism or a woolly emotional connection to the natural that I think leads us to some difficult ethical positions. Mm-hmm. So, and one classic example of that is, I think many animal advocates, completely understandably, are totally focused on animal farming, given that's something that, you know, humans are doing today that causes industrial scale suffering and death to, you know, hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of animals and fish every year. You know, and that too is my focus. But some of those same animal advocates, when you ask them about wild animal suffering, will say, well, you know, that's part of nature and it's the circle of life. And they'll start to use the same arguments that those non-vegans use to justify their own consumption of animal products. Mm-hmm. Whereas to my mind, the suffering of animals in the wild is also a morally negative thing. Now, I'm not saying we should give the same priority to reducing that suffering as to what we cause directly through animal farming, but to ignore suffering just because it's part of some sort of romantic view of nature we have, I think is, you know, is a deep moral mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because that's kind of where conservation fits in to the picture. And I'm not sure we've really explored what would a vegan view of conservation be, because would we want to, and would it be realistic to just say, okay, well, look, the areas where humans don't live outside of cities, can we just return that to nature and let nature do its thing? And that'll be like back to the golden age of just how animals can live freely without our input. But even to do that, you'd have to artificially create that area and manage the ecosystem in some way in order to rebalance it. And then the other thing is, there's, you know, nature's moved on in a way and adapted to live with us. For example, with the COVID-19 stuff going on now, we've learned that pigeons in cities are starving because they eat all the like bits of food that we leave around. So, you know, if we were to, in theory, return pigeons to their natural state, they would sort of die off because they depend on us now. So there's these kind of interdependencies and so on. So it gets pretty complicated. And I don't think we have really thought through, you know, we're often, when we think about, you know, there's a lot of talk of, yeah, we need a vegan world, but what would a vegan world look like?
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a, you can sense this tension in some of the environmental movements as well. And that, you know, again, a sentientist perspective puts the environment as critically important, right? So I think we would agree on most things that environmentalists agree on as well, because the natural environment is critically important to the experiences of sentient beings, non-human animals and humans. Mm. Of course, right? So there is a very strong sentientist concern for the natural environment as well. But there's a distinction, right? So with some environmentalists, their connection to the environment is more of a romantic attachment that says more about, you know, human enjoyment of the environment than it does mean concern for things in the environment themselves. So, you know, I went to a UK humanist lecture recently given by Chris Packham, who's obviously a great environmental activist. And one of the high points for me of his speech was that he announced he'd gone vegan at the end of the speech. But the rest of the lecture was almost exclusively about the wonder of the natural world, charismatic wildlife, and, you know, the occasional mention of how wonderful companion animals are. There wasn't a single mention of farmed animals at all. And what rings through, you know, both his speech and much of the environmental movement is that their concern for the environment and for non-human animals is more about the pleasure they bring to humans than it is to do with a genuine moral concern for those sentient animals living in the environment. And there's a radical difference there that I think can lead us, you know, to consider some very different actions. Mm. And I do think, you know, there's no easy answers here, but I think if you simply focus on reducing suffering and enhancing flourishing of all sentient beings, use that as your grounding point, and you bear in mind that vermin, farmed animals, companion animals, you know, charismatic wildlife, the prey that the charismatic wildlife eat, you know, all of those things are sentient beings that warrant moral consideration. That leads you to a very different way of thinking from the way most environmentalists think, which is grounded in some sort of romantic sense of, you know, restoring nature. That, it, as I say, is much more to do with how that restoration of nature brings pleasure to humans than it is a genuine concern for the sentient beings in nature. And I think there's another angle to sentientism where I guess we're also suggesting we draw the line around sentience too. So we're also saying things that aren't sentient, you know, so I'd say plants, rocks, rivers, mountains, those things don't warrant direct moral consideration because they're not sentient. They can't experience anything. They can't suffer. They can't flourish. They can't have any well-being themselves. They are critically important because they're so critical for sentient beings, but they don't have, you know, they don't warrant moral consideration intrinsically. Whereas with some environmentalists, they are willing to privilege and grant, for example, rights to rivers and mountains and the physical environment in ways that could actually cause much more suffering for sentient beings.
Hmm.
So there's a distinction there as well between a sort of woolier environmentalism that's trying to romantically rebuild something versus an explicit focus, you know, on reducing suffering and enhancing the flourishing of sentience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like a version of saviorism as well, isn't it, really? Like,
yeah.
You know, the environment can't do without us taking good care of it. You know, humans are stewards of the earth and so on. Yeah. And I suppose if you were to grant, for example, a mountain certain rights, I mean, what kind of rights would those be? Because then you would want to ensure that that mountain has the right to exist in whatever way you've decided it should. You might need to manage the interactions of non-human animals that live on that mountain and that kind of thing. So that could get tricky.
Yeah, I agree, right? You know, a river being polluted is bad because it's bad for the fish and for the, you know, the other sentients that rely on it, but the river itself doesn't care. Mm. And if you start to think the river needs protection in a way that might actually cause harm to other things that are sentient, then you get into some difficult spaces. And you know, some environmentalists do tend to think that way. So on the one hand, you're right, there's a sort of saviorism that implies humans have to be involved in fixing everything. But more often, I think we're too hesitant about humans getting involved, where actually just letting something return to nature in some circumstances could cause much more suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at something like, you know, rewilding, there are some types of rewilding and some species that you could reintroduce that would actually explicitly cause, you know, more suffering in that environment. So, you know, there aren't easy answers here, but I'm saying, you know, if we go back to just thinking about the individual sentient beings and their experience and what are we doing to cause suffering or flourishing, that's a much more solid grounding than a sort of woolly emotional environment.
Okay. Going back to atheism then, I have read that most vegans are atheists.
Yeah. I mean, again, anecdotally, that seems to be true. There's been a bit of research, I think, not much, but there's been some research on that intersection. And it seems that both atheists and humanists are more likely than average to be vegan, and vegans are more likely to be atheist or humanists as well. So it does seem that there's already a sort of latent overlap between those two worldviews that is interesting.
Yeah, it is, especially considering what we were talking about earlier, the kind of pseudo-religious messaging of the movement. And again, you've seen this kind of stuff come out with the coronavirus stuff, because with most vegans being atheist, also a lot of vegans will say, well, coronavirus is karma for meat eaters. It's like, so we're picking little bits of misappropriated religious concepts when it suits us.
And it's similar to the humanism challenge, and the anthropocentrism is, we'll criticize those things, but then we'll accidentally use them in some of our arguments, and I think it weakens our position. To my mind, you know, we've all had this conversation where people talk about veganism being dogmatic and being like another religion and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And to my mind, it's precisely the opposite, right? When veganism is well-founded, we're very simply following the evidence, using reason, because it's crystal clear that most non-human animals are sentient and they can suffer too. And we're extending our compassion to them. You know, it's rock solid in that context. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's people who are continuing to consume animal products who are either denying the evidence and reason, or deliberately, you know, as I did for many, many years, just deciding not to think about it and not reasoning about it. So continuing to consume animal products is much more like a religious mindset that, you know, ignores evidence and reason and applies compassion very selectively rather than in a universal way. But I agree. I think if we use religious style arguments, you know, we fall into that trap of being appropriately accused of being dogmatic and not based on evidence and reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So outside of animal advocacy, then, you'd mentioned, or maybe I've made it up, but I've read it before, about artificial intelligence.
Yes.
So I guess there's a focus, if we're talking about sentience, on at some point there may be artificial intelligence that develops some kind of sentience, if sentience is a kind of information processing thing. So where do we go with that?
So many sentientists, maybe most of them, find it really irritating when I talk about this, because it's really clear that if we're concentrated on moral consideration for sentient beings, that humans and non-human animals exist in their, you know, hundreds of billions today and undergo enormous suffering, right? So that's where the priority lies in terms of campaigns and focus and, you know, activism, very, very clear. But at the same time, I do think it's quite useful that, you know, the worldview is future-proof. So you could imagine going from, you know, a humanist perspective to something that, you know, and there is another term out there of animalism, which says, look, we should have universal compassion for all animals, and you could extend to that degree as well. But in a way, even that perspective is somewhat arbitrary, because the thing that really determines what we should be compassionate for is that characteristic of sentience. And if sentience really is, like consciousness, just a class of very advanced information processing, to my mind, there's no reason in principle why you couldn't imagine some other form of substrate or some other form of being that is also sentient, and whether that could be some form of alien sentient life or some form of artificial intelligence that we build or ultimately builds itself. You know, it may seem like an intellectual curiosity at the moment or a distraction, but I think it's useful that the worldview, you know, is future-proof and that it focuses on the characteristic of sentience rather than picking, you know, a particular type of biology or a particular set of species to have compassion for. And it's interesting because, you know, many people do see those things as distractions as problems we might have to face in a few hundred years. But there are also some very advanced thinkers who think it, you know, it could happen quicker than we anticipate. So it's sensible to ethically be ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it's frustrating people talking about should robots have rights and so on? Should we start thinking about that now?
Yeah.
And the discussion of should non-human animals have rights seems to be so niche and ignored still.
Yes.
But obviously in kind of tech circles and that kind of thing, you know, artificial intelligence is a hot topic for them. So they're going to be talking about this kind of stuff. And another one that annoys me is, you know, that companies are treated as legal persons,
yeah,
but animals aren't.
Absolutely. And I see, you know, and that latter point about companies echoes our conversation about rocks and rivers, right? You can care about a company because it's important to its employees or its managers or its shareholders, but it's not a sentient entity in its own right, the same way as a river or a mountain isn't either.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen real anger from animal advocates about the robot rights discussion because, you know, rightfully they think, what the hell are you doing focusing on a topic like that when there's such an obvious, egregious, horrific, catastrophic harm being done to things that we know are sentient already. And I empathize with that anger. But actually, if you engage in those conversations, that's another great way of landing our point. Mm-hmm. Because if you start to talk to, and I've spent some time talking to the AI ethicists and robot rights people, and you zero in on, you know, what is the characteristic that would really trigger us needing to have moral concern for a robot or an artificial intelligence, you zero in on sentience as a characteristic, you can then have that conversation about other things that are sentient already today that we completely ignore. And you can also draw parallels from the way we treat non-human animals, or indeed have treated other, you know, out groups of humans, to the way that some ethicists are thinking in the robot rights and AI ethics world. Mm-hmm. So I think engaging in those conversations can actually be a productive way of getting another group of very influential academics and intellectual figures to actually get much more serious about animal advocacy too. So there's a way through that conversation. You know, one of the very live debates going on in robot ethics at the moment has a direct parallel to animal advocacy. And there are some very leading thinkers who are suggesting that we take a relational approach to thinking about robot rights and AI ethics, in that they say we should determine ethics about robots based on how those robots have a relationship to humans. And I think that's deeply, deeply dangerous, not because, you know, I'm particularly concerned about the robots, but because it's that mindset that allowed humans in the past to categorize outgroup humans as slaves. It's that mindset that allows humans today to classify farmed animals in a very different way from companion animals and charismatic wildlife. And again, it's embedding that anthropocentrism. You know, it's all about what humans think and what humans find as important. That determines morality.
Mm-hmm.
So again, engaging in those sorts of debates can bring us back to some topics that are deeply important to human rights and to animal rights today. So I can understand the anger, and I can understand the frustration that people are even thinking about focusing on a topic like that, but actually engaging it constructively and talking about something like sentientism as a basis for the craziness of robot and AI ethics enables us to have that conversation about animal advocacy with a, you know, a very influential group.
Okay. That actually leads me on to thinking about anti-speciesism and how that fits in with sentientism. Because I'm wondering, how comfortable could someone who, I know we touched on it earlier, but it seems to me the main difference between anti-speciesism and sentientism is that anti-speciesism will say, well, it doesn't matter what level of sentience a being has, because what actually matters is what matters to that being.
Yeah.
You know, that they don't need a purpose in this world, and they don't need us to decide on what part of the sentience spectrum they sit. So they're here with us, and they should just be left to do their thing. So how comfortable can an anti-speciesist be incorporating sentientism or understanding sentientism in their advocacy?
Yeah, I think I'd be interested to hear people's views on this, because I think they can be completely consistent, because sentientism is one way of rejecting speciesism. It's saying, don't use species as a boundary, use sentience instead. And there are many sentientists who say that everything sentient should be granted equal moral consideration, which I think would be completely consistent with anti-speciesism. There are, you know, and I would include myself in this, other sentientists who do think that there are potentially gradients of sentience which could give us different degrees of moral consideration to different degrees of sentience, and clearly different species on average do have different levels of sentience, if that's the case, which could leave me open to some form of accusation of being speciesist under the covers, if you like, and you know, we could have that debate. I guess my points would be that even for the minimally sentient being, I'm still according moral consideration to it, so I don't want it to be harmed or killed. So there is still that baseline, even for the minimal sentient. But yes, I am still reserving the right to make graded moral considerations of based on degrees of sentience. So if an aphid is sentient, or a chicken is sentient, and a human is sentient, you know, yes, I would. If you put some nasty trolley problem in front of me, I would take decisions based on privileging the human over the aphid.
I think there's a lot of conversation to be had on that, because I think in the vegan movement generally, there is actually a big focus on sentience, because we're trying to get people to understand that anyone who's sentient should be worthy of consideration. So it almost, I think it is like a sentientist movement, and probably not an anti-speciesist movement.
Yeah.
And there's a drive to make it into an anti-speciesist movement, or to create an anti-speciesist movement, because what anti-speciesists are seeing in the vegan movement is kind of a lack of the kind of political will. I'm not sure how to put it in words, but vegans are, in a way, veganism is kind of become like a welfare movement.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because of the sentientist aspects, and what anti-speciesists are saying, look, we need to be a lot more, we're basically combating anthropocentrism. And so a lot of vegan views still are coming from that speciesist mindset. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot of different aspects.
The welfarist angle is a fascinating one, because the way I summarize it is that causing less suffering is better than causing more suffering. But the suffering that remains that you're causing is still unconscionable and immoral. Mm. So, you know, I think a sentientist perspective actually personally leads me to quite a hard line about the welfarist mindset, and that, you know, less suffering is better than more, but it's not a justification. You still have to think about the experience of each of those sentient beings and what's being done to them. So that leads me to take quite a hard line on the sort of welfarist perspective. It's not a graded concern in that sense. It still sets a very strong negative baseline about the morality of needlessly causing any suffering.
Okay. So sentientism then, in fitting into the wider animal liberation movement, I guess it's still quite a niche. Do you want to tell us something about, you know, who's involved, or what the community looks like, and that kind of thing?
Of course. So, I mean, it might be worth setting out a little bit of history about the term as well. So originally it was developed by philosophers like Richard Rider and Peter Singer in the 70s and 80s. And it was always a naturalistic philosophy. So it was partly used as an alternative to the sort of religious or supernatural mindset, and a way of saying, look, sentience is what we should focus on, and we should expand our moral circle to everything that's sentient. So in a way, all I've been doing in the last 2 or 3 years is taking that and recasting it to say, let's not just use that naturalistic worldview when deciding what things are sentient and whether to care about them or not, but let's expand it to apply evidence and reason in all domains and all remits. And that's where it does become almost like an extension of an atheistic or a humanistic philosophy, where we apply evidence and reason in every respect, to every field, to every domain, as well as having compassion for all sentient beings. The idea, or the term sentientism, or sentientist, has been, you know, a very niche sort of part of the animal advocacy or animal ethics field for a long while, and hasn't really picked up popular following at all. And I've been somewhat amateurishly in the last while seeing if there's interest in building or partly refining that philosophy in that recasted way, but then building a bit of a movement around it as well. So it still remains very niche. I've done a little bit of writing, written some articles, done a few podcast interviews like this one, just to sort of share the ideas. And we've been building some interesting online forums and communities so far as well. They've probably reached, you know, single digit thousands of people so far. We have people from 65 different countries involved in our main online community forum at the moment. So it seems to have, you know, a reasonable reach. But yes, it remains quite a niche audience.
How would people find out more then? Where would they go to learn more about sentientism?
So the easiest place to go, it's a bit of an ugly website, but it's just hosted on my webpage at the moment. If people go to sentientism.info, INFO, they'll see a page of some articles and links and interviews and links to some of the other forums as well. We're on Twitter at sentientism, and I'm at Jamie Woodhouse. There's also a Facebook page, but also a private group. So if people go to Facebook and search for that, everyone's welcome to that. You don't have to count yourself as a sentientist. You just need to be interested in the idea to come along. That's probably our most lively community group. But we also have a subreddit and a Discord, an Instagram and a Goodreads group and a LinkedIn group as well. So on most of the different platforms, if people search for sentientism, they'll find us.
Okay.
And it's a fascinating, eclectic range of people. So we've got animal advocates and activists who really like the idea of grounding their work on a scientific, naturalistic basis. We've got humanists and atheists who are frustrated that humanism is too focused on humans and want to expand their moral circle more broadly to other sentients. We have academics and philosophers, both from the animal activism fields and moral philosophy fields, and from transhumanism and from effective altruism, all fields that have an interesting sort of scientific basis for focusing on morals and ethics. But most of the groups are just, you know, very interested lay people from all around the world, every continent, and like I say, 60 or 70 countries so far. So a fascinating, diverse range of voices so far.
Was there anything else you can think of that we haven't covered that you might want to mention? Or
no, I think that covers the bases pretty well. I'd just come back to that simple description that it's about a commitment to evidence and reason in choosing what to believe, and a commitment to moral consideration for anything that's sentient, anything that can suffer or can flourish. And to my mind, if we can set that as a sort of powerful universal baseline for our morals and ethics, you know, we can then, once we've got more of the world's population up to that baseline, we can focus on all of the other remarkably challenging trade-offs and trolley problems and different things we need to focus on. But that baseline helps us focus on some of the most egregious and obvious harms we're causing today, like animal farming. And I think it's a sound basis for helping us prioritize on those types of issues.
Yeah, it's interesting because one mantra in the vegan movement is obviously veganism is the moral baseline. But actually veganism, if you think about it, is a tactic. So actually, if the moral baseline is sentientism, that probably gives you more to work with, possibly.
Yeah, I think so, because it also has a lot to say about human rights as well, right? So, so you know, veganism, understandably, is about non-human animals, and that's a deeply important focus area. But we've still got an enormous amount of work to do on human rights and poverty and global health and the long-term future of humanity. There are some critically important issues there as well. So it's absolutely right to make sure we've got a really strong focus on non-human animals, given what we do to them. But that's not the only problem we need to solve. And many of these solutions, you know, the best solution actually helps in multiple domains as well, right? So if we could really expand our moral circle to include sentient animals, that would be good for humans in many ways, as well as for the non-human animals. And I think having that broader remit of being interested in not just non-human animals, but also human animals, and thinking in an integrated way about the problems that we cause and that we face, is even more powerful than just focusing on a, you know, on one subset.